do we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. This show is a ministry of the C.S. Lewis Society and supported by gifts of listeners just like you. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
As we continue our Doubts About Darwin series today, we are going to be bringing on Dr. Stephen Meyer, and we are going to be talking about the scientific side of things. And last week we had Dr. Richard Weikart. We talked a little bit more about the philosophical side. We talked about how Darwin is sort of implicit in racism and in the Holocaust, and how Darwinism had influenced Hitler and so on and so forth. So this week we are going to be talking more about the scientific side of critiquing Darwinism, and we have some really awesome information and some really good points here. So before we get into this interview, I just wanted to encourage you to share the Universe Next Door podcast with a friend. It's the best way to get our content out there in the message of the gospel. And so if you would do that, it'd be much appreciated. And if you have questions and things you're wondering about, maybe you have something that you'd have a hard time answering, or somebody had brought up to you and you didn't have an answer, or maybe it's just something you think about a lot, send us that question or that topic to information@apologetics.org. We also have a brand new series starting in June, as soon as we're finished with our Doubts About Darwinism series, where we're going to be getting into cultural issues and teaching you how to do cultural apologetics and how to think about and respond to some of the most difficult issues of our day. We will be featuring some of the most qualified apologists on how to defend the truth of Christ in the gospel in these areas. That being said, let's get started. Dr. Stephen Meyer is director at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He is an author and speaker who has done debates as well as interviews on some of the biggest platforms, including the Hoover Institute and Ben Shapiro's Sunday Special, and he's written a number of books such as The Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt, and most recently, The Return of the God Hypothesis. Dr. Meyer, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and thanks for having me on, Nick. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And you're over in Seattle, which is on the opposite side of the country from where I am in Florida.
Yeah, we're on a basically a long diagonal from you guys, and probably on the opposite end of the country as far as weather as well. We've had a super rainy May. So.
Yeah, I haven't been to Seattle. My sister had, and it was rainy, but over here we haven't seen a drop of rain in a while. So definitely, unless you go to Alaska and Hawaii, I don't think you can get any farther in the U.S.
Yeah. Certainly from Florida. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, the series we're currently continuing on The Universe Next Door is primarily focused on critiquing the Darwinian theory of evolution, so I'd love to get your perspective on some concepts regarding Darwinism, but first, your most recently published book is called The Return of the God Hypothesis. Now, Jordan Peterson, who I suspect is well-known among our listeners, is quoted as saying, "It's not often I read a book that contains so much I did not know." Now, coming from Dr. Jordan Peterson, of course, that is a pretty powerful statement, and he goes into much more detail. But my question for you first here is, what is the God hypothesis, and what are the three scientific discoveries mentioned in the subtitle of the book that reveal the mind behind the universe?
Well, the God hypothesis simply is the idea that a transcendent, intelligent creator best explains key evidences about biological and cosmological origins, about the origin of the universe and the origin of life, as opposed to other competing worldviews or systems of thought, such as, for example, pantheism or materialism, which is the dominant worldview or system of thought in the academy today and has been for quite a long time. I know you, the Universe Next Door, is very concerned with the whole issue of worldview. And so this is basically an argument that the theistic worldview that affirms the existence of a transcendent intelligence and active creator provides the best explanation for key evidence we have about how things got here, how the universe and life arose. And the three key evidences that I look at, the three key discoveries, are the discovery that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. The physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy began a finite time ago. And secondly, that the universe has been fine-tuned from the very beginning for the existence of life, meaning the basic parameters of physics fall within very narrow tolerances and against all odds to make life possible. And physicists call that the anthropic or cosmological fine-tuning. And the third big discovery or piece of evidence is that inside even the simplest living cells, and in fact, inside all living cells, in all living organisms, there is information in a digital form. There's literally digital code stored in our DNA molecules, and that is expressed through a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system. And I argue that the presence of such information is best explained not by an undirected evolutionary origin, but rather as the product of a designing mind, as a kind of master programmer is responsible for that digital code. So that's a brief thumbnail of the argument of the book.
Well, I would suggest that our listeners order that book. It's on Amazon. You can find it anywhere, but it is an amazing book. So order The Return of the God Hypothesis and check that out. Now, of course, everyone has heard of Darwinian evolution, or the theory of evolution, as we often call it in day-to-day life, but it seems that in many areas, it's something commonly taken for granted. The everyday person was taught this theory in school and has heard it in practically every area of life. In fact, my wife and I were reading a marriage book last night, and of all places, the author appealed to evolution to explain that men and women do things differently from one another, which kind of came out of left field. But all of this to say, people who aren't particularly interested in studying biology, they may sort of just assume the truth of this theory without giving an adequate amount of research. So first things first, and in simple terms, what is Darwin's theory of evolution?
Well, Darwin's theory of evolution has two parts. The first part is has to do with a pattern in the history of life, and the second part has to do with the process that produced the pattern. The pattern, the famous pattern that he argued for, is known as the tree of life, the idea that all the different forms of life that exist today can be represented as kind of branches on a tree, and if you trace those branches back far enough, you get to a common trunk or root. The universal common ancestor. And the idea of this is the idea of sometimes known as universal common descent or universal common ancestry. And it's the idea that all forms of life have arisen through a slow, gradual, and continuous process of change such that the history of life can be best depicted as a branching tree. And the idea is that that first simple organism would have morphed and changed gradually, giving rise to different kinds of organisms, which in turn would have morphed and changed, and giving rise to more and more different organisms until finally you had the pattern of life that we have today. Now, that's the first part of the theory, and Darwin offered five main arguments for that. I won't reprise them all, but he had several arguments from clues that are in the biological realm today, or in the fossil record. The second main argument is that there's an undirected, unguided process known as natural selection acting on random, he called them variations, but now modern biologists refer to both variations and mutations or copying errors in the genetic material as a driving force in the history of life. That the natural selection, random variation mutation mechanism is the process that's responsible for that gradual unfolding that he depicted with the tree of life. So the process explains the pattern. And the two together make up what's called neo-Darwinian evolution, modern Darwinian evolution, where the neo refers to the reliance of natural selection on random mutations as well as genetic variations. So, and the idea of the theory is that it explains the origin of all forms of life on Earth and also the appearance of design that those forms of life manifest. All biologists up into the 19th century and even today acknowledge that living organisms look as though they were designed for a purpose. In fact, Richard Dawkins, the great defender of modern Darwinism, on the very first page of The Blind Watchmaker, says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And for him, the key word is appearance. So in the Darwinian view, living things look as though they were designed. They have features that look as though they were designed by an intelligence, but that feature is an illusion. Those features are an illusion because there's an unguided, undirected process that can produce the appearance of design without being directed or guided in any way. And so you have design, as Francisco Ayala says, one of the great evolutionary biologists of our time, he says, with Darwinism, you have design without a designer. And I think that's another key, at least corollary of the theory. There's the tree of life picture, the history of life, the affirmation of the creative power of the natural selection and random mutation process, such that even the appearance of design is an illusion, and that you only have apparent design, not real design.
So if even many Darwinists say that things look and appear to be designed, but aren't, how do you think this theory has become so popular with so much, in my opinion, an overwhelming amount of scientific evidence that's been piled against it? How do you think it's seemingly become so so commonplace?
Well, it was beautifully argued. The initial case for it was beautifully argued in The Origin of Species. It fit with the zeitgeist of the times. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence that seemed to support it at the time, and it also fit the zeitgeist of the time. But I think there's another hidden persuader in all that, in all of this, and that is that near the end of the 19th century, and partly as a result of the way Darwin argued his case, the idea of actual design or an actual designing intelligence was ruled out of court as a possible explanation for the appearance of design or anything else we see in living systems. And this now has a name. This convention has a name. It's called methodological naturalism. And it's the idea that if you're going to be a scientist, you've got to limit yourself to completely unguided, undirected processes to explain everything, even the origin of life or the origin of the universe or the nature of human consciousness. Everything needs to yield to materialistic explanation. And Darwin was well aware that some of the phenomena that he was describing had been already explained by the idea of design. And for example, when he looked at what's called homology, the similar bone structures of different types of organisms, previous scientists have said that expressed a common design pattern. But Darwin said, but that's not a scientific explanation. So even though it was an adequate explanation or an alternative explanation, certainly, he ruled it out of court subtly with the way he developed his case rhetorically. And that convention took hold. And now in contemporary science, many scientists believe they're duty-bound to limit themselves to materialistic explanations for all phenomena, irrespective of what the evidence may say. And I think that's one of the reasons that Darwinism has remained dominant, although I actually can't say that Darwin's theory of evolution has remained dominant. A commitment to some form of evolution, materialistic evolutionary theory, has remained dominant. I think within the field of evolutionary biology, there's tremendous skepticism now about at least the mechanism that Darwin proposed, and if not the pattern as well. So, but a commitment to materialistic evolutionary explanation of some kind has remained unabated, because underlying the analysis of evidence is an a priori commitment to materialistic explanations, irrespective of what the evidence shows.
Sure. In this, actually, that's interesting, because the idea of taking God out of science completely, of just looking at things materialistically, that's not something that we see all throughout the history of science. For example, we don't see that with Isaac Newton. We don't see that with Blaise Pascal and so on and so forth. So this is a fairly new...
Robert Boyle or Johannes Kepler or James Clerk Maxwell or many of the great scientists were men of deep faith, and many brought concepts from theology into their scientific work as part of their certainly as the presuppositional foundation for science. The idea, for example, that nature is intelligible or that there is a lawful order to be found, were theological presuppositions that formed that helped form the approach of the early scientists. But many scientists believe they were also seeing evidence of design in nature. If you read the general scholium to the Principia, Newton's famous epilogue to his great work on gravitation, he makes an elegant design argument, which is essentially a fine-tuning argument about the position of the planets. And he argues that the law of gravity can explain why the planets stay in their regular orbits, but it does not explain how they acquired those orbits in the first place, how they acquired the positions that enabled the solar system to have this exquisite balance of forces that keeps it running on a day-to-day basis. He said that suggested rather the activity of an intelligent and powerful being. This was a design argument built right into the structure of one of the greatest works of physics ever written. He made a similar argument in the optics about the structure of the eye and the idea that the structure of the eye, he argued, anticipates the properties of light in a way that suggests a common cause beyond light and the eye, namely a designing intelligence of a great intelligent being. So design arguments have been part of the history and the warp and woof of science since the beginning. It was really in the late 19th century that Darwin and his followers essentially ruled them out of court. They became verboten. But I argue in this book and in my two previous books on intelligent design, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, the evidence for design is so compelling in biology, and now in the third book I make the case for design in physics as well, that we need to look at the evidence with fresh eyes and not allow the convention of methodological naturalism to decide between two competing possibilities. Either life and the universe is the product of undirected, unguided, and strictly materialistic processes, or a mind played a role. Both are logical possibilities. And to have an open approach to science, we need to consider both as we look at the evidence. To rule one out of court without even considering the evidence is, I think, at least sub-rational. It's anti-intellectual. We should want a science that wants to infer to the very best explanation, not just consider a limited range of explanations that may or may not be true.
A lot of people don't recognize that you sort of separated the fact that you can't have both an unguided process and a guided process. You can't just mix them together. And a lot of the time, I think people don't recognize that in my opinion, you really can't even make an appeal to induction in order to do science apart from a creator. And Bertrand Russell pointed out that when you try to say, well, I know the future will be like the past by looking at the past, he says that's begging the question. And so I think that the underlayment of having a designer, of having God overseeing the process of creation and so on and so forth, and giving us fine-tuning is really what makes science function properly.
Well, a couple of points about your comment. One, God could certainly, in a directed way or in an intentional way, set up a process that then functions semi-autonomously in an undirected way. He could establish the conditions of such a process. But the other point you're making is really interesting as well. It's the problem. This goes back to Hume and the recognition that it's impossible to prove the uniformity of nature by looking at nature, because all we can do is sample nature. So we can't prove that it's going to function the way it is functioning when we look all the time when we're not looking, whether that's deep out into space or far back in the past or far into the future. Rather, that's an assumption that is necessary to doing science, and one which we must tacitly invoke in all of our analysis of data. What is interesting is, whereas Hume proved that assumption can't be proven by an appeal to data, that then raises the question: well, where did the assumption come from? The uniformity of nature is actually one of those presuppositions that the early modern scientists brought to the study of nature because of their theological convictions. They believed that nature was orderly because they believed God was a God of order, a God who favored order, who created order. And that made it possible to look at nature and to assume that the future would be like the past, and to make predictions based on their observations and make explanations based on their experience. This is just one of many examples of specifically Judeo-Christian presuppositions about nature that made science possible.
Sure. Now, as I had mentioned, the series we're doing, we're kind of critiquing Darwinian's theory of evolution, and you had mentioned a few things. You kind of broke down what his theory of evolution was. And now my question to you is, there is a big issue with Darwin's theory, and that big issue is the fossil record. Now, you've written extensively, and in fact, you've dedicated most of a 400-plus page book called Darwin's Doubt to what is referred to as the Cambrian Explosion. And interestingly enough, Charles Darwin was aware of the Cambrian Explosion and had even mentioned the threat that it made toward his theory of evolution. Now, what is the Cambrian Explosion and what issue does it present in regard to Darwinism and the fossil record?
Well, the Cambrian Explosion refers to the abrupt appearance of most of the major forms of animal life that have ever existed on the planet, the geologically abrupt appearance. This occurs in the Cambrian period, at the beginning of the Paleozoic era. And so the standard dating for that, for the explosion itself, is about 520 to 530 million years ago. It happens that it's one of many events in the history of life where the fossil record records an abrupt appearance of new forms of life. But this is particularly dramatic because most of the major groups of animals that have ever lived come into the existence at that time. And that corresponds to these new animal forms are representing unique body plans, where a body plan is a unique arrangement of body parts and tissues. And so one of the iconic body plans is that of the arthropod, depicted by, for example, the famous trilobite. But you have many other body plans that first arise, chordates. Animals with notochords or backbones, in this case, primitive fishes first arise, worms of various kinds with different body plans. And so you have this panoply of different forms of life that emerge very suddenly without any discernible connection to ancestral forms in the lower pre-Cambrian strata. And that's the key issue, is that there doesn't seem to be anything to which you can connect them in the lower strata, which would enable you to depict the origin of those animal forms in a tree-like fashion, as Darwin did. And so rather than seeing evidence of gradual or continuous biological change, you see evidence of discontinuous and abrupt change in the Cambrian fossils. And then again, in many, many similar events throughout the history of life, the overwhelming pattern of appearance in the fossil record is not one that would lead you naturally to depict the history of life as a tree, but rather maybe something more like a lawn, or perhaps an orchard of separate trees. So you have discontinuity rather than continuity. So in Darwin's Doubt, I call that problem the mystery of the missing fossils. And I examine several attempts that paleontologists and evolutionary biologists have made to try to solve the problem, one of the most prominent of which is known as the artifact hypothesis, the idea that the fossils that are missing are not missing because they weren't there. They're missing because either we haven't found them yet, we haven't searched hard enough, or because the depositional environments, the sediments in those lower layers beneath the layers that document the Cambrian, were for some reason incapable of preserving the remains of the animals that were there. Now, after 160 years of exploring, and specifically exploring the sedimentary layers beneath the Cambrian period, as well as other layers, the idea that we simply haven't found them and that we haven't sampled the fossil record extensively enough, I think, has lost pretty much all credibility. There's even some really sophisticated arguments from sampling theory showing that as we discover more and more fossils, they typically fall into the categories that we already know. And after a while, you realize, oh, you're getting a full picture of what's out there. So that version of the artifact hypothesis has failed. The second version of the artifact hypothesis, the idea that the ancestral forms have not been preserved because there was something inadequate about the relevant depositional environments, has also I think, been very, very directly refuted by the fossil finds around the world. There are many, many Cambrian and Precambrian layers that preserve soft tissues or soft bodies. But one particular example of that, I think, gets the point across very nicely. There's a huge Cambrian find in southern China near the city of Changjiang. It's in the Maoshishan Shale. And in the layers beneath the Maoshishan Shale, that the Maoshishan documents the Cambrian explosion. The layers beneath it, in another sedimentary layer called the Dushantu Shale, Chinese paleontologists have discovered small, microscopic, soft-bodied organisms. Some have argued that they're sponge embryos. There's some controversy about that, but they're certainly small and soft, small organisms with soft tissue. And that raises a huge question. If the sediments are capable of preserving small microscopic organisms with soft tissue, why didn't they preserve the hard parts of the presumed ancestors of things like trilobites or early fishes or many, many other organisms? And the Chinese paleontologists have concluded the best explanation as to why those intermediate forms are not preserved is that they weren't there. There's nothing wrong with the depositional environment. It preserves soft microscopic organisms. So why not the hard, larger organisms? It seems that the Cambrian explosion was a real event. We've got to reckon with that one way or another, and we can't explain it away as a result of this artifact hypothesis idea.
Well, thank you for listening to part one of this interview with Dr. Stephen Meyer. This Thursday, we are going to be releasing part two of this interview, where we're going to continue to talk about the Cambrian explosion, common objections to it, and even what Darwin may have thought if he had knew about the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. So check back next Thursday for part two of this interview, and thank you so much for listening to The Universe Next Door.